This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
One aspect of Russian life that struck Walter Benjamin during his stay in Moscow was the marked convergence there of the various temporal strata of existence that were otherwise easily distinguishable from one another in industrial Europe. In Russia, the old and the new, the archaic and the modern, worked in tandem, he observed in a letter to Hugo von Hofmannsthal. He wrote there, "I have concentrated less on visual than on rhythmic experience, an experience in which an archaic Russian tempo blends into a whole with new rhythms of the revolution, an experience which, by Western standards, I discovered to be far more incommensurable than I had expected," end quote. This curious rhythmic alternation between two temporalities of existence that were quite distinct from one another in the industrialized West was apparent to Benjamin everywhere he looked. The collision between archaicism and revolutionary modernity was illustrated in his visit to a factory on January 3rd, where, as he wrote, quote, "within a few meters of each other, in the very same room, you can observe the identical operation being performed by hand and by machine. To the right, a machine rolls long strands of twine onto small spools. To the left, a worker cranks a large wooden wheel by hand, the identical process in both cases," end quote. The attitude and physical bearing of the women working in this factory is also peculiar to him, for they approach their labors not like members of the industrial proletariat, but, as he puts it, as if they were doing domestic chores. He discovers in the factory the imbrication of not just two technical modes of production then, but of two distinctive subjective comportments. In contrast to the situation in Western Europe, where capitalism had largely succeeded in dissolving and integrating each region's specific cultural, social, and technical infrastructures, resulting in a single unified and frictionless plane of exchange, in NEP-era Russia, by contrast, pre-modern archaicisms could still be found operating alongside state-of-the-art industrial technologies. This pronouncedly non-Hegelian, non-teleological temporality of development, of course, had been the theme of one of the films that premiered that winter in Moscow and that Benjamin went to see 2 days after his visit to the factory, namely One-Sixth of the World, in which Dzigavertov had documented the traditional labor practices of the country's minority cultures, connecting the work performed in these distant, seemingly marginal locales to the factory sites of the industrial proletariat. Here on the left, on the right, you see a Samoyed, a national minority in the north, and on the left, a proletarian. These are two elements of Vertov's film. He's constantly shuttling back and forth between the two. Like Vertov's film, Benjamin's impressions from his visit to the Moscow factory provide a good illustration of Trotsky's analysis of Russia's particular economic and technological situation, one that Trotsky famously characterized as that of quote-unquote, combined development. It is this particular convergence of archaic and modern as a condition for the emergence of the new, along with its attending hermeneutic perplexities, that I intend to focus on this afternoon. If we follow the paleoanthropologist André Leroy Gorin and his commentators such as Bernard Stiegler, the technical mode of production found in any given society engenders at the level of subjective experience a distinct noetic framework for understanding time and causality. Which is to say that every technical mode produces not just a particular genus of material object, for example, the artisanal thing or the industrial object, the industrial apparatus, but this mode of production also produces an entire mental architecture of time as well, an intuitive explanatory scheme that organizes the temporality of human endeavor and dictates the logic by which individual acts are translated into collective history. Beyond the walls of the factory, Benjamin registers everywhere this temporality of Russia's combined formation, to use Trotsky's phrase again. Here's Benjamin, quote, "the ticket collectors in the streetcars remind me of the primitive peoples of the north. They stand at their spot in the car, enveloped in furs like Samoyed women on their sleds," end quote. In some of the most memorable lines of the Tagebuch and in the article that he subsequently published in the journal Die Kreatur, he documents the strange laminates of time that overlie each other in the topography of the city itself. "In the streets of Moscow, there is a curious state of affairs," he writes. "The Russian village is playing hide and seek in them. If you step through one of the high gateways, you stand on the threshold of a spacious settlement. Opening before you, broad and expansive, is a farmyard or a village. The ground is uneven. Children ride about in sleighs. Sheds for wood and tools fill the corners. Trees stand here and there. Wooden staircases give the backs of houses, which look like city buildings from the front, the appearance of Russian farmhouses, end quote. In contrast to Berlin, which he characterizes as a smooth surface that is deserted, desolately clean and swept, Moscow is, quote, rurally formless and perpetually sodden from bad weather, thawing snow or rain, end quote. Capital and province, the coordinates of center and periphery, are indistinguishable in this space. Quote, nowhere does Moscow look like the city itself. At most, it resembles the outskirts. Snow lies deep, and if all of a sudden silence falls, one can believe oneself in a village in midwinter deep in the Russian interior, end quote. Standing on Tverskaya, a major traffic artery that once led to the town of Tver, about 160 kilometers away, Benjamin feels as if what lies before him, quote, were really still the open road with nothing to be seen far and wide except the plain, end quote. Like Freud's image of the eternal city, in which all successive moments of history exist in a logically impossible condition of simultaneity, past and present coexist in Moscow alongside and even often on top of one another. Clockmakers, he observes, have no vocation in Moscow, because the notion of linear mechanical time that unfolds unidirectionally has no purchase here. Even at the most basic experiential level, everyone seems to inhabit a different historical moment. Not just the seeming Samoyed who takes the ticket in his street in the streetcar. This interleaving of past and present creates a particular challenge for Benjamin's interpersonal relationships. He's traveled all this way from Berlin to see his romantic interest, Asya Latsis, but so often he fails to find her and is instead left waiting for her to appear. But there's something more going on here than just Benjamin's bad luck and love, for the city is full of these kinds of missed connections. Moscow, in 1926, was a city with over 2 million inhabitants living on a relatively small geographical surface area, almost literally on top of each other in the case of communal apartments. And yet they all seem, strangely, always to be out of sync with one another. Benjamin writes, for example, about trying and failing to meet up with Yevgeny Gniedin. I waited in vain, he writes. A few days later, I learned that Gniedin had been waiting for me in the very same room. It is almost impossible to explain how this could have happened. It is conceivable that, exhausted as I was and given my poor memory for faces, I didn't recognize him in his coat and cap, but that the same thing should have occurred to him sounds implausible. End quote. Although Benjamin and Gniedin are waiting for each other in the very same room, being somehow out of phase, each fails to encounter the other. We are reminded of Bloch's memorable lines about non-synchronicity from 1932. Quote, not all people exist in the same now. They do so only externally by virtue of the fact that they may all be seen today. But that does not mean that they are living at the same time with others, end quote. The fabric of time in Moscow was riddled with small wormholes, local vortices of space-time that spirit the city's inhabitants out of the dimension of universal mechanical time. Thus, Benjamin writes, quote, if on the street a scene is being shot for a film, he's talking about the passersby, if on the street a scene is being shot for a film, they forget where they are going and why and follow the camera for hours, arriving at the office distraught. In his use of time, Benjamin concludes, the Russian will remain Asiatic longest of all, end quote. And just to recall my earlier point about the relationship between the mode of production and specific framework of temporality, I would just like to point out that the term Asiatic is obviously also a term that Marx used to refer to a specific mode of production. If we follow the semiotician and the cultural historian Yuri Lotman, the striking overlay of the old and the new, of the Asiatic and the industrial capitalist that was experienced by Benjamin in Moscow was just an intensification of a particular tendency to which Russian culture is naturally prone anyway. In a classical study on comparative cultural modeling, Lotman contrasted the inherently bipolar cultural logic of Russia with the ternary cultural models found in the national traditions of Western Europe. In Russia, Lotman explains, there are always only two cultural valences of a given phenomenon, one positive and one negative, whereas Western cultures add to this binary a third neutral term. To give an example, the Russian Orthodox Church recognizes behavior that consigns its agent either to heaven or to hell, but there is no neutral behavior in this cultural logic that corresponds to purgatory. As Lotman explains, in Russian culture, there is no axiologically neutral zone in between the two poles of meaning. This binary cultural logic, Lodman adds, also establishes a unique temporality of history that is specific to Russia. Russian development knows no historical continuity. It knows only extremes. In Russia, the new will always take the form of a decisive break with what preceded it. Thus, Lodman observes, Russian culture will exhibit reactionary and progressive tendencies, but never conservative ones, never ones that are gradualist. Continuity is alien to Russian culture, which instead tends toward, as he puts it, quote-unquote, total eschatological change. But before we dismiss this binary logic as semantically impoverished in contrast to the more variegated ternary structures of Western cultures, I would like to point out that Lotman also argues that Russia's cultural extremism engenders a different structure of historical time, a specific structure of historical time, and one that I believe is very Benjaminian. According to Lotman, Russia's cultural proclivity for extremism actually results not in total breaks with the past, but in strange coalescences between the past and the present. This is because, Lotman explains, creating an image of the new always entails creating an artificial image of the old as its antipode. In Russia, the two are co-constitutive. Thus, during the Christianization of Russia, for example, the Orthodox Church actively generated pagan ritual as its opposite. Here you can see Lotman's structuralist method very, very clearly. What I'm more interested in is how he extrapolates from this method a particular model of time. So in Russia, the new does not replace the old, but rather inverts it, as he puts it, writing the old into the new, albeit with a minus sign. As a result, the cultural symbology of Russia turns out to be double-coded in so many instances. Negatively construed, pagan gods are identified with devils, but when positively construed, they become Christian saints who replace them functionally. Lotman analyzes the oscillation of a number of the loci classici of Russian culture, from the bathhouse to those big, bushy Tolstoyan beards, in each case demonstrating how, in seeking to annihilate the culture of the past, Russia instead always ends up preserving it in the form of anti-culture, resulting in a constant regeneration of archaic forms. Russia, then, is a crisis-ridden culture, one predisposed to sudden, dramatic, and total change. In his last major book published in his lifetime, entitled Kultura i Vzryv, or Culture and Explosion, from 1992, also a significant time in Russian history, Lotman explored the particular temporality of Russia's culture from the perspective of complexity theory and the philosophy of emergence, focusing in particular on the intervals of historical change, what he calls the Vzryvi, or explosions. Much of this book's thinking about the temporality of culture is indebted to the work of Russian-born Belgian chemist Ilya Prigozhin, whose research into complex dissipative systems in the 1970s provided Lotman with an explanation of the mechanism by which novel phenomena emerge historically. According to Prigozhin, the introduction of random elements that increase the complexity of the system also increase the system's general unpredictability, leading, this in Lotman's adaptation of Prigozhin, to a condition that Lotman calls explosion, or vzryv. This is the moment of maximal complexity, which Lotman writes, quote, is situated between the past and the future as if it is ripped out of time, end quote. This interval of maximal complexity cannot be parsed according to the categories of lived chronological time, past, present, and future. Here again is Lotman, quote, the moment of the vzriv is not just the point of formation of new possibilities, but the moment of the creation of another reality, a leap and a recomprehension of memory, end quote. At this moment of explosion, at the moment of maximal informativity, the past and the future converge. As Lotman puts it, all variations of history become, at this moment, equiprobable, ravno vjerojatni. It is a moment of interruption in which it becomes possible to glimpse historical relations in their pure paradigmatic state outside of linear time. Within this interval, terms are reshuffled, and out of this reshuffling emerge new phenomena. Insofar as the moment of historical equiprobability is also the moment of the system's maximal informativity, it is hermeneutically inexhaustible. This indeterminacy is reflected in the opening lines of Benjamin's Moscow essay, when he insists that it is impossible to arrive at certainty through an objective examination of the facts. You'll never get anywhere if you try to interpret what you see in Moscow. You must instead decide beforehand what it is that you will see. Russia, he writes at the outset, quote, obliges everyone to choose his standpoint. Admittedly, the only real guarantee, here I'm continuing with Benjamin, admittedly, the only real guarantee of a correct understanding is to have chosen your position before you came. In Russia, above all, you can see only if you have already decided. At the turning point of historical events that is indicated, if not constituted, by the fact of Soviet Russia, The question at issue is not which reality is better or which has greater potential. It is only which reality is inwardly convergent with the truth, which reality is inwardly preparing itself to converge with the real. Only he who has clearly answers these questions is objective, not toward his contemporaries, which is unimportant, but towards events, which is decisive. Only he who, by decision, has made his dialectical peace with the world can grasp the concrete. But someone who wishes to decide on the basis of facts will find no basis in the facts. Doch wer anhand der Fakten sich entscheiden will, dem werden diese Fakten ihre Hand nicht bieten. The injunction to ideological commitment that Benjamin expresses or seems to express in these lines has far less to do with issues of political conviction or party affiliation than with a solution to a certain condition of hermeneutic perplexity. The logical corollary of a statement that you can see only if you have already decided is that if you do not decide beforehand, you won't see anything. The only way to make sense of the incoherent facts is to take a position, any position, arbitrary as this position will be. Benjamin himself is not even particularly convinced that the Bolshevik experiment in the end will succeed. I cannot assess all of this, he wrote in a letter from Moscow. Basically, the situation here enables and requires one to take a position within it, even though this might be a skeptical position in many respects. From the outside, all you can do is observe it. It is totally impossible to predict what's going to come of all of this in Russia, perhaps a truly socialist community, perhaps something entirely different. End quote. According to Lotman, undecidability is a fundamental characteristic of cultural phenomena which that perceived within this moment of explosion, within this moment of equiprobability. It is a moment, as Benjamin puts it, in which it is totally impossible to predict what's going to come of all of this. It is an undecidability based not on an absence of meaning, but in a surfeit of meaning, in an excess of intelligibility and informativity. The moment of explosion manifests itself hermeneutically as a kind of semiotic compression, a space of coalescence, Lotman calls it, or he also calls it an interval of semiotic uncertainty. This is one of the reasons that translating zryv as explosion, as translators have done, is kind of problematic, because an explosion has such a, as I was discussing with Sergei Ushakin present today, is zryv also has the Russian word zryv. Can be used to describe both explosive and both explosion and implosion, and there's an interesting way that Lotman deploys it to describe at once something that has an expanding motion, but also something that's coalescing, a kind of convergence. Anyway, this coalescence, or this semiotic uncertainty, as he calls it, produces a quote unquote double reading of one and the same cultural fact. The compressed or coalesced object is overdetermined in the psychoanalytic sense, a concept that, as many of you know, Freud defined as the lamination within a single image of a number of meanings that are often irreconcilable and even antagonistic with one another. In the Zrif, this kind of paradoxically coalescing explosion, we perceive a simultaneity of antitheses, although importantly, this simultaneity of antitheses is not a sublation of these terms, and in this regard, Lotman is very explicit, for this compression is something fundamentally different from a Hegelian unity. We tend to think of early Soviet Russia as an ideologically uniform and univocal place, but if we look closer, the exact opposite seems to be the case. Cultures of explosion are profoundly ironic cultures, for every symbol in such a culture always displays two incompatible meanings at once. Thus, when Viktor Shklovsky sat down in 1923 to compose the preface to his book Night's Move, he found it impossible to summarize the diverse contents of the volume he had himself just written. Many of the individual texts in the collection contradicted the others, some even contradicted themselves. As he explained, the dynamic culture of the revolutionary period could not be reconciled with a single perspective or reduced to a common principle. Here I quote Shklovsky, "Some say in Russia people are dying in the streets. In Russia, people are eating, or are capable of eating, human flesh. Others say, in Russia, the universities are functioning. In Russia, the theaters are full. You choose for yourself what to believe. But why choose? It's all true. In Russia, there's also something else. In Russia, everything is so contradictory that we have all become sharp-witted against our wills and desires." End quote. Under the conditions of the Zrif, every utterance carries two meanings simultaneously, making everyone sharp-witted, whether they like it or not. I mean, one of the interesting things about, I think, Shklovsky in this regard is there's so many debates about whether Shklovsky as a writer is sincere or critical of the regime, the same debates one finds in the, you know, around the work of Andrei Platonov, but these debates really miss the point, because I think that in the case of both of these authors, you have a convergence between critique and sincerity. In his book, Semiotics of Cinema, Luttmann explains that Charlie Chaplin realized this state of contradiction as a kind of dramaturgical principle. I think this explains his immense popularity in early Soviet Russia. For the tramp is always simultaneously the embodiment of two characters at once. In City Lights, as you see here, Chaplin is flanked by two characters, the blind flower girl on the right and the millionaire on the left, who set off contrasting aspects of his character, namely elegance on the left and shabbiness on the right. For the spectator, these two opposed projections are collapsed into a single oscillating figure. I quote Luttmann, "The state of explosion is characterized by the moment of equalization of all oppositions. That which is different appears to be the same. This renders possible unexpected leaps into completely different, unpredictable organizational structures," end quote. The moment of the explosion is a moment of pure virtuality, in which all courses and all outcomes become possible. Luttmann writes that, quote, "The events that were realized and those that were not realized at the moment of the explosion are variants and could easily be substituted for one another," unquote. The condition of what Luttmann calls coalescence, or semiotic uncertainty, which is the plight of judgment within the explosion, is cleared up only in hindsight from a vantage that establishes determination and regularity, where in the presence of its unfolding there had been only unpredictability and discontinuity. The moment of the explosion, the moment of the invention and of the new, quote, conclude, this is Luttmann again, concludes by passing into a state of gradual movement. What was united in one integrated whole is scattered into different opposing elements. The catastrophically explosive becomes the historically inevitable. A logical consequence of this approach, he's talking about the gradualism, a logical consequence of this approach is the eschatological myth of the movement of history towards its inevitable conclusion, end quote. What in the circumstance of the felicitous conjuncture was a unity of contradictions begins in retrospect to differentiate itself logically into distinctive parts. After the moment of explosion, the bathhouse is once again either satanic or divine, the pagan god is either a demon or a saint, the tramp is either elegant or shabby, one speaks either critically or sincerely. After the explosion, quote, subsequent movement along different trajectories causes the particles to move further and further away from each other to the extent that variations of one object are transformed into a collection of different objects, end quote. But at the moment of coalescence, all of these objects are still oscillating, duck-rabbit-like, between their various hermeneutic resolutions. Benjamin experiences this undecidability in Moscow first and foremost on the spatial register of the city, as we've already seen. Moscow itself seems to be undecided whether it's returning to some archaic state or becoming the utopia of the future. Reflecting the fast pace at which laws and norms change in the revolutionary interval, space itself exhibits the most plastic quality. Regulations are changed from day to day, Benjamin writes, but streetcar stops migrate too. Shops turn into restaurants and a few weeks later into offices. This astonishing experimentation, it is here called Riemont, affects not only Moscow, it is Russian. In this ruling passion, there is as much naive desire for improvement as there is boundless curiosity and playfulness. Few things are shaping Russia more powerfully today. The country is mobilized day and night, most of all, of course, by the party. Indeed, what distinguishes the Bolshevik, the Russian communist, from his Western comrade is this unconditional readiness for mobilization. The material basis of his existence is so slender that he is prepared year in, year out to decamp, end quote. As with public space, so too with domestic space, which Benjamin observes is also subject to constant mobilization, to constant remont. In apartments, furniture, he points out, is rearranged weekly, eliminating all coziness and traces of petty bourgeois interiority. This is a Galaktionov design, Morozov, and then at the bottom right, Ilyusitsky designed for a 1930 apartment at the Dresden International Hygiene Exhibition. To take the example of the Ilyusitsky specifically, you can see it's the equivalent of a Murphy bed, but it's in effect a Murphy apartment. The bed folds up, and then you can pull You can see the track upon which this wall slides, and you can the space is kind of maximally convertible or fungible. The top right, this is a design by Morozov, who was in the Dermiet he was in the Khutaymas. He was a student of Rodchenko at Khutaymas, and he's designed this kind of object that is at once a dining room table, a drafting table, a writing table. It's a visually very perplexing objects. In these metamorphotic spaces filled with metamorphotic objects, existence is subjected to continuous adjustment and adaptation. An experimental enterprise whose ultimate ambition is anthropological in nature. Just as Adorno in his Kierkegaard book had observed a structural isomorphism between the monadic bourgeois self and the closed-off domestic interior which it inhabited, Benjamin sees a similar correspondence between the dynamic psyche of the new Soviet citizen and the fungible spaces of Moscow, where the boundary between public and private space has been demolished and where both are subject to constant reconfiguration. It is moreover not just the space of Moscow that is subject to continuous remont, but its inhabitants as well. We read that the lowly porter at Benjamin's hotel, for example, plans on returning soon to a job at the Kremlin, and that the current director of the Theater of the Revolution was once a general in the military. Moscow is filled with people whose biographical trajectories follow, like the pedestrians on its streets, the course of a zigzag. Under these circumstances, selfhood is defined not by internal coordinates, but by occasional constellations established by the environment. Here's a quote from Benjamin. The new Russians say that milieu is the only reliable educator. Life is, as he puts it, organized, guaranteed contact, is bound by organized and guaranteed contact with comrades, end quote. I'd like to close with a quick lateral glance at a concept that George Herbert Mead developed in his 1930 lectures on the philosophy of the present, a concept that offers a compelling articulation of the challenges faced by a consciousness that is trying to make sense of the present in medias res. This kind of exploding coalescing overdetermination of phenomena that appears at moments of accelerated historical transition. Mead calls this condition of overdetermination sociality. For him, sociality is a concept, you sort of suspend what you think sociality is, because for him, sociality is a concept that is more ecological than psychological in nature. And he extends its use to encompass the properties of many non-human complex systems, including, for example, animals. For Mead, the degree of sociality is increased when a complex system is present in multiple environments simultaneously, each of which addresses a different feature of the given object. Like Lotman's notion of maximal informativity, maximal sociality takes the form of a paradoxical state of overdetermination. Thus, Mead explains, an animal is social insofar as it is variously a predator of smaller animals, a member of its pack, a conspecific to its mate, a metabolic transformer of energy within its ecosystem, and so on. Mead also points out that in the case of humans, this is the point that I really want to emphasize here, for humans, sociality increases at moments of accelerated historical evolution and revolutionary transition, when the individual is called upon to navigate and simultaneously inhabit multiple and often conflicting identities defined by different social systems. Life takes shape only when integrated into a pre-existing force field. That's Benjamin's phrase from the Moscow essay. In early Soviet Russia, such force fields, such vectors of sociality, were not few in number. Here, in conclusion, is Mead. Quote, the social character of the universe we find in the situation in which the novel event is in both the old order and the new, which its advent heralds. Sociality is the capacity of being several things at once. The point is that a body belonging to a system and having its nature determined by its relation to members of that system, when it passes into a new systemic order, will carry over into the process of readjustment in the new system something of the nature of all members of the old. So, in the history of a community, the members carry over from an old order their characters as determined by social relations into the readjustments of social change. The old system is found in each member, and in a revolution becomes the structure upon which the new order is established. So, Rousseau had defined both sovereign and subject in the citizen, and Kant had defined both the giver of the moral law and the subject of the law in the rational being, end quote. Sovereign or subject, saint or demon, Samoyed or proletarian, millionaire or tramp, porter or Kremlin officer, Why choose? Shklovsky said, because it's all true.